For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week we've got some great titles for the long summer holidays. Frances Harding revisits the English Civil War in her tale of Dark Inheritance, A Skinful of Shadows.
She is somebody who has a hereditary gift or curse, depending on your point of view. There's a space inside her where ghosts can take sanctuary.
A group of students from New College Worcester tell us what they look for in a good book.
It's quite short, and for some readers that's quite helpful, and like, because they don't like, so I know some people who don't like books droning on.
This year's Philip Carnegie Medal winner considers the merits of literary awards, and Kwame Alexander extols the benefits of basketball. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Frances Harding is a hugely successful author of novels for young adults. She won the 2015 Costa Book Award for The Lie Tree and has been shortlisted three times for the Carnegie Medal, most recently for A Skinful of Shadows.
The third time Makepeace woke screaming from the nightmare, her mother was angry.
"I told you not to dream that way again,"
she hissed, keeping her voice low to avoid waking the rest of the house.
"Or if you do, you must not cry out."
"I could not help it,"
whispered Makepeace, frightened by her mother's fierce tone. Mother took Makepeace's hands, her face tense and unsmiling in the early morning light.
"You do not like your home. You do not want to live with your mother."
"I do. I do,"
Makepeace exclaimed, feeling her world lurch under her feet.
"Then you must learn to help it. If you scream every night, terrible things will happen. We may be thrown out of this house."
Tuppence Middleton narrating A Skinful of Shadows by Frances Harding, who joined me down the line from her home in Brighton. Frances Harding, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I've had my ears wrapped around A Skinful of Shadows for the entire weekend, and it's a fantastically entertaining book, which I think is suitable for readers of all ages. And it's another historical novel, this time set during the Civil War.
Yes, I'm fascinated by times of change. And in the time of the Civil War, there was so much change going on that some people literally thought it was the biblical end times. Everything had been turned upside down to the point where they just thought it could never recover.
And do you think you were partly influenced in writing it because of political events in the UK, where two sides have become very polarised over the Brexit debate?
Well, not consciously, but I'm sure it bled in. And certainly when I was doing the research and I was reading about this country divided down the middle, where reasonable conversations were breaking down and both sides were demonising each other to the point where they just weren't able to listen to each other, I did think, you know, this all seems eerily familiar.
For those who haven't yet read the book, can you outline the dilemma that Makepeace, your heroine, finds herself in?
Oh, I give her lots of lovely dilemmas. I'm not very nice to my main characters. But she is somebody who has a hereditary gift or curse, depending on your point of view. There's a space inside her where ghosts can take sanctuary. And after she finds herself alone in the world, she is adopted by her father's family. Not formally adopted, but given a roof over her head, allowed to be a kitchen girl. But she gradually gets the impression that this family, this aristocratic family, has plans for her. So the choice she's facing is whether to stick around in this house where at least she has food and shelter and face whatever those plans are, or whether she runs away and finds herself alone, penniless and friendless in a country that is rapidly collapsing into civil war.
She's only a young girl when she's having to make these decisions and very much expected to be guided by the adults around her. And yet I think in the storytelling, you're telling the young adult reader that they should be sceptical and make their own decisions.
Oh, absolutely. I think everyone should, regardless of their age. I try not to hammer on an anvil with a particular message, but if my books have a general message, it tends to be think for yourself. Don't let anyone tell you what to think, and that includes me.
And do you think that's easier to do through writing historical fiction rather than something that's contemporary?
I think it can be. I think it can be easier to get a bit of distance. I mean, for example, looking at divided country and so forth that we have today, well, I have a side. I am much more emotionally invested in one side and believe that they are right. I'm in my particular bubble. Whereas if I'm looking at a historical setting, the same sort of division in the past, I can have a little bit of distance. And I think that's true of all of us, both as writers and readers. We're able to step back a little bit and see the complexity of situations.
Definitely. One of the things that I love is that Makepeace moves from a Puritan household to a royalist household and then backwards and forwards. And she's reading reports of the same battles that are very, very different depending on which audience they're written for. And it makes you realise that fake news is nothing new.
Oh, good grief, no. Basically, in that time, as you say, there were these different pamphlets and periodicals, and your worldview would be absolutely shaped by those, and everyone you knew would read those. But also, the weekly think pieces weren't on Channel TV. They were coming from the pulpit. And that was also shaping and guiding how you were seeing the world.
And your characters are not immune from making mistakes, which I think is something that maybe is not taught so much at school anymore. We don't learn by trial and error so much in the 21st century. We learn from evidence.
I think I am interested in the way people learn from mistakes, but also I'm not interested in writing about perfect people. They're boring. And ideally a story should be a journey of discovery, not just for the reader in terms of what is uncovered for them, but in terms of the main character. It's much more interesting if there is an element of exploration on multiple fronts.
Yes, actually, one thing I've always rather liked about your books is that revenge is very, very seldom bloody. You don't kill off your bad characters. They're encouraged to see things from a different perspective.
Well, in a way, sometimes killing off a bad character or having them die as a form of atonement is a bit of a cop-out. In a way, it's more interesting to leave them alive and to have to deal with the consequences of their actions, and for everybody else to have to deal with their continued existence, and perhaps for everyone to have to grow a little and develop a bit of maturity in order to do that. Not all my villains survive, as you know, but some of them do, and some of them are complicated enough that you can't completely dismiss them as just villains anyway. People are complicated.
Absolutely, and there are not always clean resolutions to all problems. And the book is also very much about inheritance, and what Makepeace inherits isn't necessarily a gift that she might want, and the power that the family that she's born into is power that is being kept falsely by them to the detriment of others. That clearly was something you wanted to investigate in the book.
Yes, I'm always very interested by what people do with what they're given and how what they receive from their family or what they inherit or what is given to them as an identity that they are told is them, what that does to them. How far they can move outside it, reject it, or subvert it into something new. I am always of the opinion that we can choose what we inherit or how we inherit it.
Yes, and I mean, obviously, it being set during the Civil War, there are also questions of predestination and greater duty to church and possibly the king, which might seem fairly inescapable to Makepeace and to other characters in the book.
Oh, absolutely. But in many respects, that's why the Civil War in particular is so exciting, because all these things that seemed huge and inevitable and fundamental and inescapable suddenly didn't seem quite so much so anymore. All of a sudden, it was possible to execute a king. Nobody was sure which rules worked anymore. Could they write new rules? And at that time, a lot of actually quite radical and progressive ideas were considered. Many of them weren't taken up, but they were talked about. So I like that sense of upheaval, and that's why I felt it would be an interesting time to set this particular story, because you have a young protagonist who isn't powerful, who isn't rich, and who's up against a family that's not only got power and money and influence, but also the benefit of time. For reasons that I probably shouldn't go into, to avoid spoilers, there are characters who are very, very old, who have seen the patterns of people's behaviour, the patterns of politics and life, go on for a really very long time and have the benefit of that experience. And one of the things that levels the playing field is they assume this is a civil war like the sort they've seen before, and it isn't.
And there's a real sense of wanting there to be something solid and dependable to rely upon in a time of turmoil. Again, without giving spoilers, there's a wonderful scene where Makepeace goes to Oxford and she finds out that soap is still being bought to the king. Because the king has to remain clean because he is divinely appointed, and both sides see this, but actually one side's trying to bring him down. And it really highlights the confusion that happens during civil conflict.
And that's based on reality. And in fact, gold actually does seem to have been smuggled into Oxford in soap, amongst other things.
The book is full of humour, but there are some wonderful insights there which, well, I suppose, again, show the characters not altogether good and not altogether bad and flawed in some very quirky ways.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, I love people. I love their flawed nature. I love their perversity, their capacity to surprise you in good and bad ways, their courage and their ingenuity.
And, yes, their resilience to come back and have another go if it doesn't work the first time.
Absolutely. And also their capacity to learn. And change. That's one of the most magical things about them.
Now, you, I know, I think it's very important to bring your work into schools and to new audiences. And I was talking to some of the students at New College Worcester recently who remember your visit to them with huge fondness and I think are looking forward to the next one.
Oh, likewise. No, it was an absolute joy visiting them. I loved that and I remember it well.
Do you find you have to discipline yourself to find time to write as well as do the outreach work, I suppose, of going to schools?
I do need to try to be self-disciplined, and this is really hard because I'm not naturally a disciplined person. So while I'm aware that there are some authors who are terribly well organised and manage to do the same number of words and the same number of hours work every day, my productivity tends to vary a lot more and be a bit more chaotic. I benefit from the influence of panic and caffeine.
As you'll know from your visit to New College Worcester, your books are all in the RNIB library in a full range of accessible forms. And I certainly have been very much enjoying the audiobook version of A Skinful of Shadows, which is brilliantly read by Tuppence Middleton. Did you have anything to do with selecting her as your narrator?
Well, I was allowed to meet her, which was lovely. They actually invited me over to the recording studio. So I was able to have a conversation with her and also witness some of the recording process, which is fascinating because I hadn't realised how much input there is from the people who are monitoring, who will be continually stopping the person reading and saying, can you read that sentence again, but in this slightly different way? And Tuppence would just do it seamlessly and somehow managed to maintain the flow of the story, whereas I think the stopping and starting would completely throw me out.
Do you read your work out loud to yourself as you're editing it? Because it does seem to leap off the page in audio.
Oh, thank you very much. I don't read it out loud so much, but I sometimes attend writers' groups where we'll read out each other's work. We find that that's actually a better way of checking that it flows the way we want it to, because we're not then unconsciously guiding it to what we want it to sound like. And we get to find out if another person's mind and tongue trips over the sentence we've set up.
Your books have been made into audiobooks for many years now. Was it something that you considered when you began writing?
There are many things that I hadn't fully thought about and which came as delightful revelations. Obviously, I know that books have covers, but the fact that my book had a cover was amazing and exciting. Similarly, I think I always liked the idea of my work being read out because I'm in love with the music of language. That's something I really enjoy. But the idea of that actually happening to a book of mine was something that was almost inconceivable and really exciting when it happened.
I understand that your next novel is almost completed and will be coming out very soon.
Yes, it should be coming out on Halloween.
So is it full of more dark magic?
Very much so, yes. This one is set in a fantasy setting, actually, alternative world, and it's got a male protagonist this time. And quite a lot of the action is going to be happening underwater.
Oh. Was it different and difficult writing from a male protagonist's point of view?
Not particularly. I mean, they're people too. I'm writing about somebody who lives in an alternative archipelago where the gods are dead and are repeatedly treated as salvage that can be hauled up from the deep. So that might be a bit more of an imaginative stretch than maleness.
And the novel is called Deep Light.
Yes. That's right.
And have you selected a narrator?
Ah, well, I'm going to wait to find out what my publisher suggests.
Well, I'm sure many, many thousands of us will be waiting with bated breath. Frances Harding, thank you so much for giving up so much of your morning to be a guest on Read On. And I would look forward to welcoming you back to talk about Deep Light.
Thank you very much.
A Skinful of Shadows is available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library, and commercially in paperback, ebook, and audio. Many of Frances Harding's other novels are available in a range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. For more information, visit the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. And Frances will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, Kwame Alexander on the advantages of taking up basketball, and Frances Harding shares the books of her life. But before that, as regular listeners will know, each year we follow the Philip Carnegie Medal. It's the UK's longest-running award recognising excellence in literature for children and young adults. And so, where better to find a recommendation for the long summer holidays? This year, for the first time, the children shadowing the Carnegie Medal selection process voted for which shortlisted entry should win the new Shadowing Award. Among them was a group from New College Worcester. RNIB Connect Radio reporter Hannah Taus was on hand to record their thoughts.
I'm delighted to be here with some students from New College Worcester. We are blessed with Eben, Chelsea, Ilya and Riley, and we're going to discuss the shadowing that you've been going on for the Carnegie Philip Medal. So first of all, what I want to know is, did you all choose the same book?
No.
Oh, controversial. Okay, so let's start with, do you think that it was a good mix, quite diverse, that they put on the list? Eben?
I feel like the books on the list were quite interesting, and they were quite different styles of reading, I would say.
I liked how they varied from some being written in verse and some being written in normal, and I found it really nice to read a different way. And with verse in Braille, of course, then it's shorter lines, a bit easier to read. And then that took, of course, less time to read, and I quite liked a shorter book.
Yeah, I can understand that. Some of them have quite short chapters, which is really nice and makes it much easier. So put your hand up if you chose the book that you decided on as the winner.
Oh,
we have all four of you decided on the same winner. That's brilliant. Okay, don't tell me who it was. I still want it to be a surprise. So Did you vote for which book would win, or did you sit down and have a discussion about all of them and decide what you wanted to do? Ilya?
Well, all of us voted because everybody has different tastes, I think, and everybody is different as a person, so everybody has different opinions, so we all voted individually.
Oh, that's excellent. So did you find it quite useful talking about them between you, whether it was formally or informally?
Talking to each other, because all of us, we can always share what we like about the books, and we can talk about what plot lines we like and what like we want to happen and stuff like that. And I think it's better for us to talk to each other rather than just individually read it.
So what was it about the winning book that you decided made it so special?
Well, mine was Long Way Down, and I think I chose that because it's quite short, and for some readers that's quite helpful, and like, because they don't like, so I know some people who don't like books droning on, so I think that was quite helpful. And I thought it was very informative about like matters in what was going on in like real life now, but like it gave lots of information in a very short book. Like, I read it in less than a day, so it was quite good.
That's excellent. So could you tell the difference between the books that were written by British authors and the books that were written by American authors? Chelsea?
You could, because of some of the different wordings and how it is all written. And you could. And it's quite nice to read a different variety, because then you see it from different angles, from an American perspective and then other books from a British perspective.
So did you read the books in Braille or did you listen to them in audio? Eben?
I read one of the books in Braille, and I also, we had like a lesson, and our teacher just read out one of the books, which was good. I quite enjoyed that.
Least work possible. So if you could meet one of the authors, which would it be, Ilya?
For me, well, I'm choosing the author of my winning book, which would be Frances Harding, because I really want to know how, like, they wrote the book. I want to go into, like, in depth about, the creativeness. Because the reason I liked Skin for Shadows is because all the events correlated from the start to the end, and I love the imagination imagery in it.
Chelsea?
I would want to meet Frances Harding because of all the detail and how you feel like you're in a totally different world. And this, I would like to know where she got the idea of the book, because there's so much to know. But then I'd also want to meet the author of Rebound, because I found it so interesting and I liked the way it was written and all it, the things about basketball, and I quite enjoyed it.
Marvellous. Okay. Frances Harding has already been round the college last year, I believe. Yes. How exciting was it to meet her then?
Well, it was actually quite interesting to see her views on like how she writes like her books and what she thinks of, like her point of view on when she like reads her own books. It's quite different to everyone else's.
And then at the time as well, we didn't know that a year later we're going to be reading one of her books and then coming to see if she's won an award, because it's such a great book. And then realising that it was from the author who we met last year was really interesting. And it would be so cool to meet her again, so we can see then what's it like to meet her now, now that we've read one of her books and we've loved her book so much.
Okay, so last question for you. How did you feel about knowing that your vote would count towards the choice of the winner of the Shadowing Prize?
Well, it felt quite, like, oh, so hard to explain. Just, like, yeah, I'd make a difference in, like, that person's life, basically, because when the person wins this award, they're going to get lots of praise from it and lots of different opinions, and it's quite, I thought it made me happy, like, pretty much.
Well, thank you so much, all of you. I really hope you've enjoyed reading the books. I have to say we have. We had a great time with it. And enjoy the medal ceremony that's coming up now.
Thanks, Hannah, and the Shadowing Group from New College Worcester. And the winner of the inaugural Silip Carnegie Shadowing Scheme Award is The Poet X by Elizabeth Acevedo. And the winner of the 2019 Silip Carnegie Medal is The Poet X by Elizabeth Acevedo. Elizabeth Acevedo gave her reaction to a very successful day to R&IB reporter Hannah Tells.
I'm delighted to say congratulations to Elizabeth Acevedo on winning the Carnegie Silip Medal for outstanding contribution to children's literature. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to be here.
So, have you had any more thoughts about what you'd like to do with your Braille copy of your book?
Well, it was so nice today to meet students that read the novel in Braille as part of the Shadowers Choice Committee and to realize how much of the spacing, how much of the accessibility, just because there are fewer words in verse. And so I'm not sure what I'll do with the Braille copy, but I did have, I think, a reaffirmation of what verse can do for a community that I hadn't realized, oh, this allows literature to work in a different way. You know, one of the students was saying, prose just takes me so long to read in Braille. And so here's a way to bring stories into the world that a swath of folks can partake in, and kids who maybe will struggle or will wrestle can now enjoy a story in the same amount of time as a student who has sight. And so I'm not sure what I'll do with my Braille version, but I think I have an idea of what I will do with future books, which I think is even perhaps more impactful in terms of how I'll approach literature moving forward.
You've had the great honour of not just winning the medal, but also the shadowing prize as well. Now, tell me, which is it more flattering to win?
They both equally hold a space in my heart. It's like children. You love them both equally. But I think there is something to be said about the fact that young people voted for the shadowing group prize. Because they're like, what does it mean to be writing specifically for young people, and that the majority of people who read young adult literature are actually adults. And so to have a book that is celebrated by adults and by adults who have the best interest of children, but also by children who say, well, we don't care what the adults think, like this is what we enjoyed. I think that that kind of balance just reiterates what it means to write intergenerational stories that mean a lot to many different kinds of folks.
When the UK version of the audiobook is released, are you going to narrate it yourself?
That would be a lot of fun. I mean, I did the US version and, you know, I might be biased. I can't imagine someone doing it justice.
I can't imagine somebody else doing it justice, having just heard you give your brilliant speech.
In the way that I can, and mostly because at this point so much of it is memorized because I've been touring with it for so long. But I know there are a lot of amazing voice actors, and so I would be interested to hear what a like UK accent to some of the
I'm trying to imagine that and actually thinking that we definitely need you to do the audio version. Not that we don't have brilliant voiceover artists and narrators, we do, but you bring the passion to it, which is massive. Since you've been in the UK, have you met any of the kids that have read your book? And if so, what has their feedback been?
Well, I got to meet a good amount today. You know, it's startling to me to have a young woman come on the stage. She wanted to take a picture and she's like, you are my personal role model. And just that moment of, I didn't think I would hear that. And I didn't think I would hear that here. And just this young person who was so moved by my work that has put me in this pantheon of women she admires. I mean, it, you know, why else do this work if not to embolden a young person to be louder and take up more space and to use their voice?
Teaching has played a massive role in your desire to get children to access literature. Do you still teach?
I don't teach. I'm not classroom-based anymore. I tour the United States mainly, although I will do international trips, doing workshops. And so I'll come in and do creative writing workshops, mostly on, you know, how do you find poetic voice and what does it mean to write poetry, even if you don't want to be a professional poet? Because, you know, something I wanted to say in my speech, and it's just hard to hold it up. You know, it's so much of what I see in the leaders of the world today. I can tell who reads poetry, right? You can tell who has a level of empathy that they've learned by really delving into someone else's voice that is not their own. And so for me, that is the heart of teaching, is always like, how do I make you a more empathetic person? Literature and literacy, of course, matters. And ability in the mathematics, of course, matters. I think science is where we need to put our focus right now in terms of the school system. But If we are not teaching students how to practice empathy, we are failing them in one of the greatest parts of education that they need. And so although I am not a day in and day out teacher, I think I get to drop in and reaffirm what teachers do, and I get to bring in something that is not tested, right? I get to say, when was the last time you practiced your most human self in a way that put kindness first?
One of the most beautiful things is that frequently children find it very difficult to access poetry, to understand it, to be able to relate to it. This year, fortunately, we've had quite a lot of rhythmic prose, if not poetry itself. What do you think is changing on the landscape that's making children more open to perhaps a genre that previously they would have ignored?
I think a lot of it has to do with how it's being taught, right? That I'm hoping that there is a wave of teachers who realize, one, I don't have to teach the poems I was taught. There is amazing contemporary poetry that maybe encompasses a wide array of human experiences. And I'm thinking here, right, very specifically about what does it mean to have diversity of gender, of race, of ethnicity, of sexual orientation, of cis heteronormative. What if we remove some of those things and allow these voices into the classroom? So I think students are finding the poets more interesting and the concepts more interesting because it's not just this tradition, which a lot of folks don't know why they're teaching it. It's just what I was taught and my father was taught and my father's father. And it doesn't connect in the same way. But I'm also hoping that the questions we ask of poems are different, right? That it's, what is the emotional connection you have? What is the experience in the poem bring up for you? As opposed to, what does the poem mean? That when we try to approach a poem as a problem-solving article, or when we treat it as if it's a puzzle, yeah, students think there's a right answer versus what you find the access point based off of how it's presented to you without having to make meaning, and you'll make meaning as you go along. And so I'm hoping that is the wave we're seeing. Poetry is a part of pop culture, and so folks are changing how they approach it. And that's not to say I'm irreverent of like tradition, right? I think there are poets that I hope will forever be taught, but what does it mean to bring in the new wave of poetry and new voices alongside?
You're a performance artist as well. Do you think that showing children that you can not only access poetry, but you can access the actor inside gives them confidence?
I hope so. I mean, I haven't been called a performance artist in a while, so I just was giggling because I'm so excited by being called that. I hope that what it does, and I'm going to be very specific, especially for young women, that there is a fear sometimes of being seen. And what does it mean to have words that you strongly believe and to take up space on a stage and say, I want you to see me and listen to me on my own terms, and based off of what I believe, and because I have chosen in this moment that this is the kind of attention I want. And I hope that young women and marginalized folks who see that realize you are allowed to create the boundaries of how you are treated and when you are made a spectacle, and that it can be on your own terms to say, I am choosing to perform, and I am choosing to call attention in this moment. I think that matters.
The summer is made for stoop sitting. And since it's the last week before school starts, Harlem is opening its eyes to September. I scope out this block I've always called home. Watch the old church ladies, chancletas flapping against the pavement, their mouths letting loose a train of island Spanish as they spread he said, she said. Pipapote from down the block as he opens the fire hydrant so the little kids have a sprinkler to run through. Listen to honking calves with bachata blaring from their open windows, compete with basketballs echoing from the little park. Laugh at the viejos, my father not included, finishing their dominoes tournament with hard slaps and yells of capicu. Shake my head as even the drug dealers posted up near the building smile more in the summer, their hard scowls softening into glue-eyed stares in the direction of the girls in summer dresses and short shorts. Hey, yo, Xiomara, you need to start wearing dresses like that. You'd be wifed up before going back to school, especially knowing you church girls are all freaks. But I ignore their taunts, enjoy this last bit of freedom, and wait for the long shadows to tell me when mommy is almost home from work when it's time to sneak upstairs.
Like all the books on the Silip Carnegie shortlist, The Poet X is available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. And an audiobook version read by Elizabeth Acevedo herself is coming soon as a commercially available audio download. Do you have a favourite book from childhood? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the RNIB Library? Why not get in touch with us via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
RNIB Library has the largest library of its kind in Europe, with over 60,000 items in the collection. You choose the books, you choose the format, and we deliver to you. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999.
Now, before we return to hear the books of Frances Harding's life, another author shortlisted for this year's Silip Carnegie Medal was Kwame Alexander for his free verse novel, Rebound.
My dad was a star in our neighborhood. Everybody knew him. He taught adults to read in the mornings and taught night school to kids with problems who got kicked out of regular school. Each summer, just me and him would pack up his pickup truck and road trip to as many state capitals as we could in the 2 weeks he had for vacation. My least favorite was Dover, Delaware, because the major tourist attraction was a mortuary that processed the remains of over 50,000 soldiers. This year, I turned 12, and he promised to take me to the Appalachians, Charleston, Knoxville, Louisville to hike. And he promised to get me some fresh sneakers and let me taste beer, as long as you don't tell your mother, Charlie. But none of that ever happened. Because at 9:01 p.m. on the 9th of March, my star exploded and everything froze.
He spoke to Hannah Taus at the award ceremony.
Rebound is the story of Charlie Bell, a 12-year-old who's struggling with the death of his father and goes to stay with his grandparents for the summer. Was there anything in particular that inspired you to discuss such a difficult subject matter?
I mean, I think there were a couple of things. One was, I've always wanted to write a book about the time of my life that I had such a good time. It was the 80s, the 1980s. I always wanted to write about that era. Traveling around to promote the crossover a few years ago, kids would always ask me for a sequel. I mean, they begged me, please write another book, write another book. And that was a bit challenging, but I wasn't finished with the family. The way the crossover ended, I wanted to figure out a way to still write about their lives, their experiences. And so I thought maybe a prequel would work. And so that's where the notion of writing Chuck Bell's story at age 12 came from. In terms of the sort of heavy and weighty themes in Rebound, nobody's ever really prepared for death. You know? I feel like young people, you know, have to be given the tools to be able to move through their lives and deal and heal. And I try to write books that are real. Those all rhymed, didn't they?
That was perfect.
Deal, heal, and real. but, you know, more seriously, my mother passed away 2 years ago. And again, I didn't know how to deal with it. I was trying to rebound in my own life. And so how does a child deal with losing, you know, someone whom you love, who created you? Our mothers are our guardians, our protectors, our nurturers. And so when that person is no longer here, what do you do? How do you move through life? And so I wanted to write that story. That was important to me.
It is an absolutely brilliant story that kind of uses every trick in the book to get children interested. It's both rhythmic in its poetry, it's visual in the use of the comic strips. The layout is fantastic. It's got sports in it, and the chapters are really short. Did you particularly have in mind these ideas in order to make it as accessible as possible to get kids reading?
So first of all, you just gave away all my tricks.
Apologies.
Oh my goodness. I mean, everything you said is spot on. I set out to do that. I set out to write a book that was rhythmic, that used concise, sparse language, that used a different visual way to show the poem on the page. I love the white space on the page. I think it allows the reader to take a spiritual journey. The comics were sort of a way to engage young readers also. I believe that it's not enough to get kids to read a book. You have to try to get them to want to read a book. If you can do that, so when I'm writing, I try to employ as many different, as you call it, Hannah, tricks. I call them tips and technique and form.
I think I prefer that term.
I kind of like tricks. I'm all about tricks. So these are literary tricks that I try to use to get kids inspired, engaged, and ultimately empowered by the text.
So we have a lot of visually impaired readers. That's our audience. And I know that you've done an audiobook in the US. How difficult was it, A, to translate that into an audiobook, and B, to find the right narrator who could get the rhythm of the piece?
Kick so hot his feet glow, move so cold you see snow, tall as a cypress tree, bro, game so lit make seeds grow. In your face 3D show, game so deep it's below, air so swift you breathe slow, watch me fly from the free throw, Superman is sweet, yo, but Hannah is my hero. I mean, like, that's the beauty of the rhythm and the rhyme and the figurative language. It's made for spoken word. It's made for presentation, for performance. I try to write with that in mind. And so the sort of the translation from page, from text to audio, I thought it was this was the perfect type of, you know, genre to make that leap. Poetry does that. It's great on the page, and sometimes it can be even greater on the stage. So I didn't do the audiobook for Rebound. Like, doing that poem makes me realize I probably should have.
You can always re-record.
Maybe I can do it in the UK.
Please do. We'd love that.
We'll talk to Anderson's about that. Rebound, the UK remix by Kwame Alexander.
So, as you said, you've written a prequel rather than a sequel. How much of that was down to, as you said before, going on that journey of nostalgia, and how much of it was wanting to do something different from the normal sequel that people expect?
It was both. It was definitely both. Like, wanting to write about members only jackets. I don't know if y'all had those here. Now or Laters, those candies.
We didn't, sadly.
Pac-Man.
Yes, we did have.
Okay, you had Pac-Man. Prince.
Yeah.
Okay. Tears for Fears.
Yes, absolutely.
Everybody wants to rule the world. Yeah, I mean, so I wanted to write about all that stuff that defined my childhood, you know, that sort of made me at least think I was cool. And so the nostalgia part was really big, writing about the 1980s when I was in junior high or middle school and high school. And then, in addition, wanting to write a story that was authentic for me. I like to think that the job of the writer is to make our personal your business. Like, you have to be able to relate and connect with the story. And so being able to write about Chuck Bell when he was 12 in a way that everybody could sort of pull something from it. Chuck has a grandfather. He has grandparents who he is really close to. Like, we all got grandparents. Chuck is having some tense interactions with his mom. Like, we all have problems, you know, as kids. We all sort of, like, we're mad at mom for telling us to do something or not letting us do something. My 10-year-old gets mad at me all the time. Like, I feel like they're just, you know, there's a crush in the book between Chuck and CJ. And of course, sort of that penultimate dramatic conflict in the book is precipitated by Chuck making a bad decision to hang around with someone who he probably shouldn't be hanging around with. How many times have we decided, have we had people in our lives who are not really good for us?
Yes, his relationship with Skinny is a difficult one. He feels this massive sense of loyalty, but also is able to realize that maybe he's not the best choice of friend.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And I had friends growing up who were not the best to hang around. They got into trouble, and me being around them meant that I got into trouble. I think it's important for us to surround ourselves with people who are full of the kind of energy and life and joy and hopefulness and positivity that we aim to be. I like to say it's important to have people in your life who are say yes people, people who say yes to the beauty and the power of life, as opposed to say no people. Because if you have a lot of say no people around you, you're eventually going to become one of them.
Do your kids help you to keep in touch with the childlike or adolescent point of view?
No. I mean, sure, maybe my 10-year-old does, but I don't try to write it based on the slang that she uses around the house or how I see her interact with her kids. I'm writing about characters that I feel close to that I know. Like, I got to write my story, you know? And I feel like if I'm enjoying it, if I like it, then the chances of you as the reader liking it are probably going to ramp up a lot. So I'm not trying to manufacture cool, or I'm not trying to manufacture youth. I'm just trying to be the kid who I think I've always been and sort of how I see the world.
Thanks to Hannah and to Kwame Alexander. Rebound is available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library, and for sale in paperback and as an audio download, narrated by Ron Butler. Now it's back to Frances Harding for the books of her life. Frances, was there a book that you read as a young person that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, actually, there were quite a lot of those. I mean, I read voraciously when I was young, but for a long time, one of my favourites was Watership Down. It was certainly my favourite book when I was 10, and looking back, it was my first epic saga. And I think a lot of parents who see this bunny on the cover probably don't realise that it's actually a harrowing tale of adventure with two dystopias, the massacre of an entire community, punitive mutilation, a war, escapes, a dictator who just happens to be a bunny. It's quite strong stuff, but very good.
He ran down the field and over the brook to the cattle wade. Here there was a delay, for Fiver, surrounded on all sides by the quiet summer evening, became helpless and almost paralysed with fear. When, at last, Hazel got him back to the ditch, he refused at first to go underground, and Hazel had almost to push him down the hole. The sun set behind the opposite slope. The wind turned colder with a scatter of rain, and in less than an hour it was dark. All colour had faded from the sky, and though the big board by the gate creaked slightly in the night wind, as though to insist it had not disappeared in the darkness but was still firmly where it had been put, there was no passer-by to read the sharp, hard letters that cut straight as black knives across his white surface. They said, "This ideally situated estate, comprising 6 acres of excellent building land, is to be developed with high-class modern residences by Such and Martin Limited of Newbury, Berkshire."
Watership Down by Richard Adams is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB2576, which is narrated by Robin Holmes. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, there's one that I've always loved, which I also encountered when I was quite young. I think I was about 16. And that's A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy because it's just funny. And when I first encountered it, I sort of felt like it was giving me permission for my slightly weird sense of humour. So I always feel a happy sense of connection with it.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a wholly remarkable book. It has been compiled and recompiled many times over many years and under many different editorships. It contains contributions from countless numbers of travellers and researchers. The introduction begins like this. Space, it says, is big. Really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the road to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space. Listen. And so on. After a while, the style settles down a bit, and it begins to tell you things you really need to know, like the fact that the fabulously beautiful planet Bethsalemin is now so worried about the cumulative erosion by 10 billion visiting tourists a year that any net imbalance between the amount you eat and the amount you excrete whilst on the planet is surgically removed from your body weight when you leave. So every time you go to the lavatory there, it is vitally important to get a receipt. To be fair, though, when confronted by the sheer enormity of the distances between the stars, better minds than the one responsible for the guide's introduction have faltered. Some invite you to consider for a moment a peanut in Reading, and a small walnut in Johannesburg, and other such dizzying concepts. The simple truth is that interstellar distances will not fit into the human imagination. Even light, which travels so fast that it takes most races thousands of years to realize that it travels at all, takes time to journey between the stars. It takes 8 minutes to journey from the star Sol to the place where the Earth used to be, and 4 years more to arrive at Sol's nearest stellar neighbor, Alpha Proxima. For light to reach the other side of the galaxy, for it to reach Damogran, for instance, takes rather longer, 500,000 years. The record for hitchhiking this distance is just under 5 years, but you don't get to see much on the way. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy says that if you hold a lung full of air, you can survive in the total vacuum of space for about 30 seconds. However, it does go on to say that what with space being the mind-boggling size it is, the chances of getting picked up by another ship within those 30 seconds are 2 to the power of 267,709 to 1 against. By a totally staggering coincidence, that is also the telephone number of an Islington flat where Arthur once went to a very good party and met a very nice girl whom he totally failed to get off with. She went off with a gatecrasher. Though the planet Earth, the Islington flat, and the telephone have all now been demolished, it is comforting to reflect that they are all in some small way commemorated by the fact that 29 seconds later, Ford and Arthur were rescued.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB5072, narrated by Gordon DeLieu. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, fairly recently, I ended up reading The Master and Margarita. I've been meaning to for ages. It's by Bulgakov, and it was written in a way as a comment on the oppressive nature of Stalin's regime, but it doesn't read that way at all. It's actually very funny and a sort of dark fairy tale where Satan and his minions turn up in Moscow and start causing mayhem left, right and centre. And it has a large cigar-smoking cat who is variably sarcastic at people. And it's weird and macabre and funny and anarchic and very readable.
At the sunset hour of one warm spring day, two men were to be seen at Patriarch's Ponds. The first of them, aged about 40, dressed in a greyish summer suit, was short, dark-haired, well-fed, and bald. He carried his decorous pork-pie hat by the brim and his neatly shaven face was embellished by black horn-rimmed spectacles of preternatural dimensions. The other, a broad-shouldered young man with curly reddish hair and a check cap, pushed back to the nape of his neck, was wearing a tartan shirt, chewed white trousers, and black sneakers. The first was none other than Mikhail Alexandrovich Berlioz, editor of a highbrow literary magazine and chairman of the management committee of one of the biggest Moscow literary clubs, known by its abbreviation as Masolit. His young companion was the poet Ivan Nikolaevich Poniryov, who wrote under the pseudonym of Bezhdomny. Reaching the shade of the budding lime trees, the two writers went straight to a gaily painted kiosk labelled Beer and Minerals. There was an oddness about that terrible day in May which is worth recording. Not only at the kiosk, but along the whole avenue parallel to Malaya Brunaya Street, there was not a person to be seen. It was the hour of the day when people feel too exhausted to breathe, when Moscow glows in a dry haze as the sun disappears behind the Sadovaya Boulevard. Yet no one had come out for a walk under the limes. No one was sitting on a bench. The avenue was empty.
Steve Hodson's masterful reading of The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov, which is TB1812. Frances Harding, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.